Agriculture uses many types of machines to grow, harvest, process, and distribute the nation's food. Among the most important are the aircraft of general aviation. And so we ask, should government give our flying farmers some COVID relief?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 1240th edition of the Food Chain Radio program. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends up there in Quebec City who are tuned into the Food Chain podcast at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What. Folks, the Made in China pandemic is wreaking economic havoc throughout our world, leaving no one untouched, save maybe Jeff Bezos. The rest of us are left to watch our economy melt away. One can see the melting away in the vacant streets of New York City. Yes, the city that formerly never slept now can't seem to wake up. And how about our empty restaurants, where conviviality was the order of the day, but where the only orders coming in these days are for takeout? But what about the real important economy, the one that brings us our daily bread? What is happening to our agriculture? Tough for us city people to see what's going on out there in farm country, is it not? Perhaps it's time to look away from the hopelessness of big cities and ask about the welfare of our farmers. And so today we pause to ask, what impact is COVID-19 having on the nation's rural heartland and the farmers and ranchers who grow our food out there? Well, here to help us have a look, we have two fine distinguished gentlemen, one from Minneapolis, one from Maryland. We'll start with Neil Ritchie, who is a senior advisor to the Main Street Project. Neil, welcome to the Food Chain Radio program.
Great to be here.
So you're up in Minneapolis working as a senior advisor to the Main Street Project. What is the Main Street Project?
So the Main Street Project is a nonprofit organization that has been working for the last 15 years on sort of alternative approaches to rural economic development, finding ways to strengthen the farm economy and to diversify the food economy in the region around southeast Minnesota.
Good. And then who pays the way for your organization? Where do you get the money?
So we raise money from private foundations predominantly, some from the federal government for various kinds of USDA programs. And we do some research and development work on a demonstration farm that the State Department of Agriculture also supports.
Good. And you, as a senior advisor, well, what do you advise them to do?
Well, I was actually the founder and the CEO for 15 years. And so I'm helping as I sort of fade into my next iteration and helping turn over to a younger generation of leadership. So I advise on a variety of things and keep active with the research farm.
You're the guy they won't quite let go, right?
Well, sort of.
Fair enough. Okay, on to the Chesapeake Bay and Neil Colby, who is the Government Affairs Director for the Maryland Farm Bureau. Neil, or Colby, welcome to the Food Chain Radio program. Colby Ferguson.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, Maryland Farm Bureau. Tell us a little bit about the Farm Bureau.
Sure. You know, it's some people kind of think that we're a government agency because we have Bureau in our name, but actually we're a nonprofit organization as well. It's member-driven, starts at the grassroots level, and our primary members are farmers, as well as we also have the ability for citizens that want to see farming stay viable in Maryland and around the country. They have the ability to be members as well.
Well, I don't know many people out here on the West Coast who know much about Chesapeake Bay agriculture. So, and read a little bit about it in your op-ed, in a recent op-ed that you wrote. Very fascinating. What it's hard to remember about Maryland is that it has so many different seashores.
We have the largest number of acreage of shoreline of any state in the country. You wouldn't think Maryland would have that many, but when you look at the coves and necks of the Chesapeake Bay as it winds its way up to the Potomac River and up through the northern branch, it really does have a lot of connections. So we have an eastern shore and we have a western side, which we call it, so that's split by the Chesapeake Bay. So yeah, the Chesapeake Bay is huge. We probably, I mean, outside, you know, you have the tributaries that run from the northern states down into it, but as far as the ones that actually have the bay, Maryland has the bulk of it.
Mm-hmm. Well, my daughter now lives in Virginia Beach, Virginia, so I'm learning a little bit about the Chesapeake Bay as we go along here, a magnificent body of water, but my wife insists there are no fish in it. Is that true?
No, there's quite a few fish. I mean, we have the Maryland blue crab, one of the delicacies. If you ever eat it, if most people know about our crab cakes, and our crabbing industry is still very strong. Have a burgeoning oyster aquaculture industry that's really coming on and utilizing that to kind of be dual purpose. One, to meet everybody's oyster needs, but also to try to help clean up the bay and remove nitrogen from the water, and kind of a dual purpose economy there.
That's a good. Well, gentlemen, what attracted me to the both of you was a press release essentially pleading for help for general aviation. And now, having been raised a pilot, I got my pilot's license when I was a kid growing up in Montana. Yeah, little airplanes and big skies. But so I pay attention to just pretty much everything that has to do with aviation. And I don't suspect most people connect aviation with agriculture other than perhaps a crop duster or two that they've seen while driving through the countryside. So maybe we should stop here a little bit and talk about aviation. First of all, you talk about general aviation as opposed to commercial aviation. So what's the difference? Neil, let's start with you.
Well, general aviation is, I would say, everything that's not the big airlines that are carrying passengers and cargo around the country and around the planet. So we have small plane operators. We have, you mentioned, agricultural crop dusters. We have healthcare, emergency services. You know, there are small planes and small airports all over this country, and they provide a real fundamental piece of infrastructure in rural America that connects us in those places that the commercial aviation simply doesn't serve. So they're really a lifeline and an integral part of rural community life, and so it serves agriculture, yes. It also serves a bigger purpose of mm-hmm. just rural community services in general.
Well, you know, we have one of those general aviation airports here in Watsonville, California, and it was very interesting because when we had the great big Loma Prieta earthquake here a number of years ago, we couldn't get in and out of town. The airport was the only place to serve the community at the time. So hugely significant. And as I understand it, Colby, we have 5,000 of these airports all over the United States.
Yeah, they're you know, here in Maryland, we think of Baltimore, Washington International, or Dulles, or Reagan National that takes you into D.C., Baltimore, or Northern Virginia. But when you really get to looking at it, there's a lot of smaller airports that do service those rural areas, and that's one thing that, you know, on the agriculture side is absolutely critical. I can't fly a crop duster or a service plane out of Baltimore Washington International, but I can fly it out of Talbot County's regional airport over on the Eastern Shore. So having those smaller airports that aren't dominated by the Southwest Airlines or the Deltas or Americans is essential, but they get forgotten pretty quickly.
Mm-hmm. And Neil, it's a significant industry in itself, is it not? I understand it's a $247 billion a year industry.
Absolutely. You know, I get my information from an organization, the Alliance for Aviation Across America, that's done some pretty good reporting on the economic impact state by state. But yeah, it's $247 billion. It's 1.2 million jobs are connected to it. And it's in every corner of every state in this country.
So let's talk then a little bit about the number of uses it has in agriculture itself. You know, when we think of the farmer out in the field, we see him on a tractor, but sometimes they're in an airplane. Neil, you spoke most Colby, you spoke most eloquently of that in an op-ed piece on crop dusting or using crop dusting airplanes in Maryland there. And it was not just for spraying pesticides either, was it?
No, actually, probably the particularly in Maryland, where we're a pretty urbanized state that's not very big, the ability to do the big crop dusting type things is actually kind of the way of the past. But more importantly is, you know, because we have the Chesapeake Bay, we have our water quality, you know, trying to save the bay, trying to address climate change and different things that farmers are trying to do, cover crops is a huge piece to making sure that ground stays covered year-round, whether it has a cash crop on it during the summer or just a maintenance crop to prevent soil erosion or whatnot. And so we're finding that being able to fly on either with a helicopter or with a biplane and fly those seeds onto those growing crops, that when that farmer comes through and harvests the corn or the soybeans, that next crop is already seeded and has already started to germinate and come up, and you just don't have any downtime for erosion. So it's been a huge practice that we've used for water quality improvements, as well as now we're seeing the climate improvements as well. So whether it be carbon sequestration or whatnot. So it's, yeah, the thought of the crop duster, maybe not necessarily as much in Maryland, but certainly for our cover crop program.
Mm-hmm. And you also talked about the scale of agriculture growing bigger and bigger and bigger, and how that having an airplane makes a big difference there as well.
Yeah, I mean, we're, you know, fortunately or unfortunately, how you want to look at it, we're not keeping up with the number of farmers with the pace of the population, not only in Maryland but in the country. And so when fewer and fewer farmers are growing all of our food, we turn into what we call a land-based agriculture, which means that we've got more land than we have farmers to farm it. And so those practices, those farmers only have 24 hours a day and 7 days a week. So to cover all that territory, they do utilize the services of helicopters and planes instead of having to jump on the tractor and drive around the field around in circles all day long.
Good. And we're going to have to take a quick break, but when we come back, I'd like to have you address how it's the significance of using those airplanes to seed cover crops, the difference that's making in the water quality in the Chesapeake Bay. We just touched on that, but it's a hugely significant body of water that stretches, all the way from Virginia all the way up to Washington, D.C. And so how are you going about protecting those bodies of water there by using aircraft? So this is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson, we will be right back. This is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What. Today we're looking at agriculture in the rural parts of our country, starting on the eastern shore in Maryland with Colby Ferguson, who is a government affairs director of the Maryland Farm Bureau, and going to Minneapolis and the Great Plains and whatnot with Neil Ritchie, who's a senior advisor to the Main Street Project. And specifically, folks, we're talking about aviation, general aviation, and its use to grow and process and ship the nation's food. Very important machine for agriculture. And Colby Ferguson was talking about its use there on the Maryland shore and the importance of using aircraft to help maintain the water quality of the Chesapeake Bay. Now, I know that there's been a big fight to restore the waters of the Chesapeake Bay for quite a while. How are we doing on that front, Colby?
It depends on who you ask. Some say that we're doing outstanding. Some say that we're not getting the job done. So it just depends.
Well, wait a minute. Let me guess here. I would guess that agriculture is saying we're doing a great job, and the environmentalists would say we're doing a terrible job. Am I wrong?
That's pretty close.
Pretty close.
I think, you know, our biggest thing on our end is that, you know, our biggest worry is when you start to look at the cost to do all the water quality improvements, both at the in the urban areas as well as in the rural areas, it looks cheaper to do it in the farmland because there's just less people and less cost. But when you look at the population differences, to put that burden on the farmers, you know, and what a lot of our farmers will say is like, why are you penalizing me to clean up somebody else's mess? And so that's a big challenge. But, you know, we've stepped up since 1985 with nutrient management plans and use of no-till farming and cover crop. And I would have to say that Maryland farmers are probably ahead of most every state when it comes to best management practices for water quality, for sure.
Well, don't farmers make a good target? You know, you're out there standing in your field.
What a great
target.
I think the biggest way to look at it is look at the population density per acre. So I'm one person owns 100 acres versus one person that owns an apartment complex or lives in an apartment. The number of votes that are covered by my rural acreage versus an urban acre start to count pretty quickly. So we get to be an easy target because there's just not many of us.
Yeah. So let's go back to then the management of the Chesapeake Bay waters by virtue of using an airplane. And you talked about cover crops, but how exactly does that work, Colby?
Sure. So under what we call the to spread it aerial through the aerial format, you have two options. One is via an airplane, and the other is a helicopter. And we see the airplane used much more on the eastern shore because it's more wide open. There's not as many towns. It's flat. But we see the helicopter used a lot more over on the western side, you know, between Baltimore and Washington and that area where there's no where we don't have an issue with any no-fly zones. We'll see the helicopter used. And what's really unique about a helicopter is that as those helicopters, as that downward pressure, you know, if you've ever gotten into a helicopter, you have that wind that's blowing you straight down. Well, that works exactly the same as you hover over a field and you drop the seed. That downward pressure, it just shoots that seed down through a growing crop, whether it be a corn or it be soybeans or whatnot, and it gets it down to the ground level. When you fly it over with a plane, you need to have less leaves and things like that, less foliage to make sure it gets to the ground. But the biggest value is it allows you to plant the next crop before you harvest the existing crop that's in the field.
And what happens if you don't?
If you don't, you just take that chance that, you know, if we could predict when the rain was going to happen, when a hurricane was going to come through in the fall or whatnot, then it would be easy. But when you don't know and you go out and you've got the corns ready to be, you know, big combine, you know, goes through the field and you harvest it off, that time frame of getting that no-till drill back out there and drilling that seed into the ground, letting that seed then germinate and then get up and growing, that week or 2 weeks of time frame leaves that ground susceptible to any kind of rain or storm event that could happen.
And of course, if the field is full of mud, it's really difficult to drive a big truck around in it.
Yeah, that's one thing we found in 2018 when we called it the monsoon season around here. We had probably twice as much rain during the summer and fall than we had in decades, and we just found that you couldn't get out onto the fields. It was very difficult to get the harvest off. But then it was almost impossible to get the drill back in there to put it. And so the fields that got cover crops, most of them were put on by an airplane.
There you go. Well, let's head back to Minneapolis with Neil Ritchie. And, Neil, there's a lot of other uses for aircraft in agriculture. Let's kind of talk about some of them. Aerial observation.
Absolutely. I mean, people are increasingly, you know, there's a, I mean, drones are doing some of this, but there's a need to continue to watch the landscape and the, you know, Michael mentioned, Colby mentioned the floods of last year and the rain events, you know, being able to watch and manage the flow of water, which is a significant problem for us up in the upper Midwest as well. You know, doing survey work. Here in the Midwest, of course, we're sort of row croppers and we have fields that are not wide open plains, but out in the western plains, up in the mountain areas where there's a lot of rangeland and a lot of timber, of course, keeping an eye on, you know, possibilities of forest fires and managing those events, which happen with increasing frequency, it seems like, is there's, you know, years of drought. So, I mean, the having the planes available for keeping an eye on far-flung regions where there are fewer people to manage, of course, is really critical. And I just want to say that one thing that, of course, struck me when Colby was describing the use in Maryland, we're increasingly seeing that same use. So I think the best practices that they've been developing out there are also now becoming part of the thinking about how you manage your lands here in the upper Midwest. Mm-hmm. And so we're seeing more and more of that kind of cover crop seeding, which is part of trying to keep the chemicals and the soil away from the waterways that are going into the Mississippi and into the Gulf of Mexico. I mean, it's a significant improvement in a lot of ways, but it's something that's increasingly becoming a part of the farmers' toolkits here, not just something imposed on them, but something that actually helps them be more efficient with the other chemicals that they have to use. So it's a big shift.
All the good practices seem to work together, don't they?
They absolutely do. They absolutely do.
Well, another thing, other than observing how things are going, I know a lot of ranchers in Montana, of course, have great, big, huge parcels of land that they have to manage and often see them flying around counting cattle and things like that. But just general business operations, like let's say you're running a herd of combines through the Midwest and you got to keep chasing them with mechanics and whatnot.
Right.
That's one good thing. Put the mechanic in the airplane and keep them going from one place to the next. Get around like that. Do you see a lot of that being used?
You know, there's more and more of that as we get to those kind of, you know, contract combine and field management practices. And there's places, you know, like Alaska where just ordinary business and the movement from town to town is basically almost entirely done by general aviation. So
they can move people around that way. I know that here on the California Central Coast, a lot of the berry growers and greens, salad greens, they have ranches, they call them, here, there, and everywhere. They kind of follow the climate. You know, they start way down in Mexico and work their way up and back and forth. And they fly a lot of their farmers and their service people back and forth to the farm. So a lot of transportation being done there as well. And then we were talking just about general land management, so keeping track of how we're going about managing our land so that it's a lot more friendly to the environment and produces a lot more crops. And then we also touched on the uses in the rural economy in general. And this is something you hit on in an editorial, I believe, that you wrote, Neil, talking about how aviation serves the small cities for disaster relief and whatnot, and have those 5,000 airports, just small little chunks of blacktop where airplanes can land and take off and take care of business. It's hugely significant. So what then... Why the call for action? Why did you ping me and say, Michael Olson, we got to talk about this? Neil?
Well, so the issue that I think probably came to your attention was the request that a number of organizations, including Colby's and mine, made to the Congress to ask for some forbearance on fuel taxes, to ask for taxes to be waived on the purchase of fuel, diesel fuel, the airline aviation fuel, for some period of time, to give some economic relief to the sector, which includes, of course, emergency medical, the firefighters, the agricultural interests, and so forth, because the industry itself is, of course, under stress, as almost all industries are in the era of COVID, and the large commercial airlines and the commercial airports have already gotten both significant direct cash injections as relief, but also relief from passenger and fuel taxes. And so this is really, in one part, it's about equity, but it's mostly about trying to do something to help continue to support the industry in this time of declining, declining use and so forth.
Well, let's talk a little bit about what changes COVID has affected on agriculture. I live pretty close to San Francisco and can watch the parade of commercial airliners flying in and out of the big city metro airport. And, pretty much there's like in the good times, there was one every minute and a half. It was incredible. Now, there's so very few. It's like one every 15 minutes, a half hour. So I look up in the sky and I don't see any commercial airliners anymore, or very few. So what is happening with general aviation? Neil, you want to pick that one up?
Sure. I think there's just a sort of a similar decline, right? So it's not quite the same because it's not the same passenger load, but so much of this is tied to economic activity. So, for example, a company with manufacturing facilities in five communities, in North Dakota, Minnesota, Wisconsin, that would normally have management and, mechanics and other things flying around, there's less of that. I think there's probably been more reliance on it for medical, emergency medical, and other kinds of, support that come with rural communities having sort of less access to critical care facilities. But in general, I think as the economy slows down, it slows down all the activity.
Mm-hmm. We're all in Zoom meetings now, right? Instead of in airplanes, we're in Zoom meetings. Colby, what are you seeing on the East Coast there?
Well, I think the biggest thing that we've seen, obviously I'm down on the farmer level, and so I'm kind of looking at, our access to services and access to products and things like that, which in many cases, particularly on the products, whether it be seed or fertilizer or crop protectants, the vast majority of that does travel by land. But our biggest thing that we just saw with COVID that just to make sure you still had the services being provided, that the businesses weren't shut down, that they were still considered essential. That probably in April, late March and early April, when everything really just shut down in pretty much every state, including Maryland, just making sure that the agricultural services were still considered essential, because you can shut down the economy, you can shut down a lot of businesses, but you can't shut down producing food for everyone. So that was a big, big deal that we worked with at the state level, at the federal level, and just trying to keep everything essential. And one of those components was making sure that our general aviation locations were still considered essential. So I would say as far as COVID-related, just making sure we could continue to get what we needed to continue to produce food was a big, big deal we had to focus on.
Now, who on earth would argue against agriculture being an essential business? Can you think of anybody?
If they eat three times a day, they probably consider us to be essential. If they or they don't know where their food comes from.
Well, what do you think?
Figured that out. Yeah. I think they figured that out when they went to the grocery store back in April and May and found the shelves to be completely empty.
Yeah, there you go. So we're looking at big changes here all the way around and how we're going to go about coping with them. And we're looking at the federal government, and the federal government is going to have to be making changes. And one of the big ones I see coming down the pike is the proposal to privatize air traffic control system, ATC. Now, I don't know how this would work for general aviation. Does anybody have any guesses?
Well, it wouldn't be helpful, and this is part of why the Alliance for Aviation Across America, which I referenced a little bit earlier, has done a lot of work trying to make the case for the economic value and the critical nature of general aviation. I mean, you know, the commercial airlines want to have control of it, which means that the underperforming, quote unquote, the smallest of general aviation airports would be eliminated. There's just no question about it. And privatizing, you know, basic public safety services like this never made much sense, but it's really about economic control and having power over the system that the airlines would like to monopolize. And so, you know, it's a dangerous proposal in my opinion, in our opinion, and one that we've continued to resist.
Well, okay, we're going to have to take a quick break. But when we come back, I'd like to pick that up a little bit because to me it's a hugely significant impact on general aviation and on agriculture and all other industries that rely on general aviation. This is The Food Chain. Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What with Neil Ritchie, Senior Advisor of the Main Street Project, and Colby Ferguson, who's the Government Affairs Director at the Maryland Farm Bureau. We will be right back. Well, we are back. This is The Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What, and today we're talking a little bit about the impact of COVID on the nation's agriculture, what's going on with our agriculture out there in farm country. It's easy for us city people not to know because how are we supposed to know? Nobody's showing us what's going on television. Mostly it's about the decomposition of our big cities. And so we wonder, is our agriculture surviving? Well, that's a good question. Neil, are we going to survive? Is our agriculture going to hold up through this COVID stuff?
Absolutely it will. It's been here since the beginning of time just about, and it will absolutely continue. It will continue to adapt, and it will take different shapes, I think. I mean, it's not simply COVID and the demands on the food system that are part of it here. There's also, you know, shifting weather patterns and, you know, that adaptations and changes are constantly being made. And so I think as long as we pay attention and we have the systems of training and support that the farmers and the next generations of farmers need, I think we'll be in good shape.
Well, you think, with respect to the climate change, you think you're going to be growing bananas up there in Minneapolis, in Minnesota?
No bananas, but maybe a few more vegetables than we used to.
Okay, good. Well, Colby, what do you think? Do you think that agriculture is going to be able to stand up to this COVID business?
Oh, I think so. I mean, honestly, if one thing that people I've seen on Facebook a couple of times is farmers have been social distancing for decades. They don't really like people, and that's why they farm. So social distancing hasn't been a problem for them. I think, you know, the biggest challenge that we see in a lot of things is because we are very efficient at growing food, and the distribution network and how that food gets from the farm to the fork sometimes can be the weak link when you have things like this. So the farmer can grow it. It's just when all of a sudden the worker, the processor or the worker are not there to finish the product in between, that's where the link can be broken. So yeah, that's our biggest challenge that we have.
Well, Colby, you brought up something earlier that I would like to pick up because I see it as as a focal point for the conflict between city and country, and that is population density. You have 100 acres and I live in an apartment, and so the votes in the city are going to vastly overwhelm the votes in the country. And what I see shaping up here is a real hard fight for whatever government money the government can come up with here in the near future. And you're asking for some of that money to be, you know, directed toward general aviation and agriculture. And I suspect that there are those in the city who are going to want it to rebuild what's left of the cities. So how are we going to go about fighting for that money? Neil, let's start with you.
Well, I would say that the system, there's two things. One is that the system is already built in such a way to with the Senate and the apportionment of House seats to make sure that there's a balance and that rural states and rural interests are well represented. I would say that the agricultural industries and the support industries are very sophisticated at the work of lobbying and maintaining. We built industries and we built bureaucracies around supporting industries. But I also think increasingly that people understand, and you mentioned the empty store shelves Colby did in April. I think people really do understand that having access to food in their local stores and in their regions is critically important. And so I think we can make the case for continued support. I don't think we're at a scarcity point yet where it's dog eat dog, but if we get to that place, you know, you want to eat the dog or you want to eat some fresh vegetables.
There you go.
That came from, right? So.
Well, you know, I've done 1,200 and some editions of the Food Chain radio program, and some time ago I came up with three laws of the food chain. And the first law is agriculture is the foundation upon which we build all our sandcastles. And this is a good example of that. We can lose our agriculture, then we will have nothing left. But hunting and gathering, and that won't last very long these days. So, but we have to fight for the money. We have to fight for the attention. And Colby, how do you suggest we go about fighting for the money and the attention and the affection of those city people who are locked up in their apartments?
Well, I think the biggest thing is you absolutely have to make sure you show the return on investment. That's whether you're talking with a fiscal conservative and maybe a little more on the Senate side that's more maybe balanced versus when you get to the House side that maybe is not as balanced. You have to make sure that they understand the value that, you know, what is its use? You know, what is general aviation actually used for? And the value that it does for rural economies, as well as the services that it provides to make sure the urban areas are provided with the food that they need to survive. So, and we've got so many issues with food deserts and things like that in the urban areas that we're not going to be able to they're going to be compounded if all of a sudden now our rural areas don't have the necessary services to continue to provide what they need.
Well, I wonder about that because you're not far from some very, very big metropolitan areas. And those metropolitan areas do have some very significant food deserts in them, which is to say places where you can't get good food. And the only thing you can get are the foods you can get in convenience stores or liquor stores. Mm-hmm. So would that not be a great way of selling city people on the value of the countryside is to figure out how to bust up those food deserts somehow?
I think if this pandemic hasn't given a greater appreciation for where people's food comes from, then we're never going to be able to say anything that's going to make them change. So, I mean, we've had the perfect experiment to see what's out there, and if we don't act and react and make changes, then it's COVID this year, it'll be something next year, it'll be something the year after that. So we have to be progressive and make change, and I think this is a great opportunity to shore up some you know, the cost is not astronomical to make sure that these general aviation places stay open and stay viable. I think it's just a sound way of utilizing our public dollars for the return on investment.
Neil, you were talking a little bit earlier about finding ways to increase the value of that rural countryside in Minnesota there. Is that relationship with the city, can that be part of that?
It's the cornerstone of it, the relationship of urban areas to the productive farms and farmland in the surrounding areas. I mean, you know, on the one hand, we've had this global experiment and bringing up fresh, as you mentioned, bananas, of course, is a classic example. But bringing up, you know, seasonal goods from the southern hemisphere is an expensive proposition. And just to say that, you know, your second and third laws of agriculture, farther we go from the source, the less control we have, and cheap food isn't, those are both right on the money. So we could be producing food closer to the urban areas. In the surrounding regions, we still need production agriculture. We still need to grow soybeans. We still need to have animal agriculture. But we could be producing a lot more of the food that people need in cities, close to cities, if we're intentional about it. We can shrink the impact on the climate. We can shrink the footprint, save money on transportation. But the main thing here is to make sure that we understand that cheap food isn't, and begin to put the resources in the system to compensate for the work that's being done both by farmers taking care of the land, but also by the workers that are in the food chain. So there'll be a big adjustment in this economy post-COVID. I just hope that we're able to put agriculture in its rightful place and to have more balance.
Well, perhaps we need to. And if we don't, we'll really be in big trouble if we don't. Because what will then support us? I have no idea what it would be.
Right.
Not at all. So we're talking then about aviation and agriculture and the need to support not just agriculture, but our rural communities by sustaining and maintaining general aviation and its fleet of small airplanes and its massive combine of 5,000 little airports around the country. So how are we going to do that? Neil?
Well, we're going to continue to make the case in the halls of Congress and in the state legislatures for the value of these. You know, these are pieces of infrastructure like water systems and electric grids, the network of general aviation airports are critical hubs for economic activity, for the support of agriculture and other industries. And, you know, we're not looking for direct cash inputs at this point. We're asking for some forbearance for the operators who utilize that infrastructure, for the people who own and fly the planes and the helicopters. We're asking for some forbearance on fuel taxes that is, you know, already is a tool that's been used to try and take some of the pressure off of industries. It's already been done for commercial aviation in terms of passenger fees and fuel taxes. And so, you know, we can make our way with the system that we have as long as there's, an equitable approach to it. And then on the other side of it, if we need to look at other kinds of development strategies to secure them or to get new technologies as we move into the future, we'll do that.
So going back then one step to the air traffic control system, which is a federal government operation that directs traffic and keeps everybody separated. It's truly a miraculous piece of organization. If the government decides to sell that to the commercial aviation, what then happens to those of us who fly around little airplanes in big skies? What is to become of us, Neil?
You know, I think it's Katie bar the door. You know, it's the Wild West. A lot of small airports will no longer be supported. They will be closed. They won't have the kind of air traffic technology, control technology. So a lot of communities will lose service. I think that's a given. Others, the cost of that service will go up. I mean, there's not much future for the big airlines in managing other than a few hub, maybe a few hub facilities to feed passengers into their big networks. But in terms of investments in technology and investments in staff and so forth, they have no interest in this. So,
well, Colby, how do you see this shaking out for those people who are flying seeds onto the shores of Maryland's Chesapeake Bay?
Well, I think if anything, I think one thing that we can definitely see that COVID has done, and you alluded to it earlier, you don't see the airlines in the, you don't see the airplanes in the air like you used to. And so you know that the big airlines are just really just bleeding profusely right now and trying to stay alive. And some of them probably won't, and they'll have to consolidate. And if all of a sudden you turned over these smaller public-run airports to these private entities, they're gonna bring all their resources in as close as possible to keep their main hubs open. And you can guarantee that 5,000 general aviation airports would be cut in half, if not even a fraction of that, just over sheer profitability. So if it doesn't stay within the public sector, I think it will become a dinosaur pretty quickly.
Should they be owned and managed as public utilities somehow?
That's the direction that we asked. You know, we've got several of our counties and our some of our small towns or larger towns within those counties that the airport actually resides in. They want the ability to maintain those, but they need the funding, and that's the biggest key is that, you know, they're trying to pay for schools, they're trying to pay for road infrastructure, they're trying to pay for all the other amenities that goes within a city, and to try to cover this cost as well is just over the top. And so they're willing to maintain them and reside over them, but they're going to need the federal assistance to be able to afford to do that.
Well, goodness sakes, gentlemen, that's all the time we have, but I want to thank you for joining me today and opening our eyes to what's going on in the sky and how what's going on in the sky relates to what we eat for dinner. Neil Ritchie, Senior Advisor for Main Street Project, and Colby Ferguson, Government Affairs Director, Maryland Farm Bureau. Gentlemen, thank you so much for joining me. And remember Mike Lowell's first law of the food chain. Agriculture is the foundation upon which we build all our sandcastles.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with Michael Olson. And if your friends missed the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen.